If there is anything that is good that has come from my lips, may it be from the Lord, and may he use it to his glory. I would, before I forget it, like to thank you for inviting us up here, for the good time you have given us, the opportunities to get to know some of you and just to have the fellowship with you. For tonight, I was asked to speak on small groups a little bit, so I'll try to do that. I don't consider myself a guru on this particular subject, but what I can, I would like to present to you, and I'm trusting and hoping at least that it might be helpful in some ways. We tend to look at the church as a building. We look back to the first century church, and just the idea of it being a church brings to our mind a building. A church is in a building, right? That's the way we have experienced it, and we think it's always been that way. Or we kind of have that impression anyway. It hasn't always been that way. The building was not directly connected with the church as such. The church was the people, and the building was where they met. We find in the book of Acts, in chapter 5, verse 12, that the Christians in Jerusalem, the early Christians, when the church was really young yet, that they met in the temple in a place that was called Solomon's Colonnade. This we find in chapter 5 of Acts and verse 12. The apostles, it says in verse 12 of chapter 5, performed many miraculous signs and wonders among the people, and all the believers used to meet together in Solomon's Colonnade. And I think it is a part of the temple. I'm not completely sure of that. There was a place where was available to them, I guess, and that they used especially for the first while anyway. In chapter 9, verse 20, we find that Paul, especially very early, and Jesus did so as well, used the synagogue. The temple, of course, was just in one place, just Jerusalem. The synagogues were meeting houses that the Jews had wherever they lived. And in Acts chapter 9, Saul spent several days with the disciples in Damascus, it says, after his conversion. At once he began to preach in the synagogues that Jesus is the Son of God, and so on. And anybody who has read the book of Acts realizes that Paul and his co-workers made use of the synagogues very much to meet and to preach the gospel, as long as they were allowed to. They did not have, for the first while anyway, they did not have houses of worship or houses of meeting of their own. And then in chapter 12, verse 12 of Acts, we notice also that they met in houses, private houses. Chapter 12 and verse 12 as well. Peter has been in prison. The angel has just released him from prison. And it says in verse 12, when this had dawned on him that this was real, because he thought that this was happening in a dream, when this had dawned on him, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, also called Mark, where many people had gathered and were praying. Peter knocked at the outer entrance, and a servant girl named Rhoda came to answer the door, and so on. So he knew, apparently, that there was a meeting going on there, or that there were meetings there. And so that was the first place he turned to maybe he even knew that they were meeting there to pray for him. So and then we have many references beyond that as well, showing us that the early Christians very often met in private houses. The church in your house, Paul says sometimes to some of his people. The church is not necessarily connected to a building. The step seems to have been the temple, the synagogue, private houses, and eventually special buildings when there wasn't too much persecution. I think these came up quite early, special buildings, if there was not persecution. If there was persecution, then it of course wouldn't have worked. When our forefathers started out, very often they couldn't have buildings. They met out in the forest in a clearing, or perhaps in a private home. I think they would have avoided having drums or guitars. I think they would have tried to keep their services somewhat quiet, so that the authorities wouldn't notice that they were meeting. And the early Christians many times had that experience. I have a portion of a letter here that Pliny, the governor of Asia Minor, wrote to the Caesar of Rome, to Trajan. And he asks in this letter how he should treat the Christians. He describes to him how he had some of them executed, and how he tortured some of them to find out what they were doing, and so on. And it's just interesting, I thought, to notice the kind of meetings that they must have had. I'll just read you a few sentences here. He says to others, and this is Pliny writing to the Caesar of Rome, asking for advice. Others named by the informer first said that they were Christians, and then denied it, declaring that they had been, but were so no longer, some having recanted 3 years or more before, and one or two as long as ago as 20 years. They all worshipped your image and the statues of the gods and cursed Christ. See, that was the way they found out whether they were real Christians or not. They had to worship their gods and they had to curse Christ. And he says here that he has heard that real Christians, you can't make them do that. But they declared that the sum of their guilt or error had amounted only to this. And here we have his description of what these people had said about their meetings. That on an appointed day, they had been accustomed to meet before daybreak and to recite a hymn to Christ as to a god, and to bind themselves by an oath. Probably the wrong word used there. Probably those Romans didn't really understand exactly what it was, but obviously a covenant or a promise. He says an oath, not for the commission of any crime, but to abstain from theft, robbery, adultery, and breach of faith, and not to deny a deposit when it was claimed. After the conclusion of this ceremony, it was their custom to depart and meet again to take food, but it was ordinary and harmless food. See, the Romans had the idea that the Christians were killing babies or that they had human sacrifice and ate human flesh. So he says it's harmless food, and they had ceased this practice after my edict, in which, in accordance with your orders, I had forbidden secret societies. So in a situation like that, it's not very likely that they had their own church buildings where they met. They were small groups, and that's another thing that's kind of interesting. Now we have big churches, and we think of dividing them into small groups. Then it was a matter of necessity. They met before daybreak, and probably in small groups, so that they wouldn't be seen. And they had their worship that way. We had small groups in Paraguay, quite a few of them. And our aim was to make them grow. We wanted larger groups. But we are talking now of dividing into smaller groups, or the dynamics of small groups. And I'd just like to, first of all, look at it from the point of view of the historical side of small groups, and then a general evaluation of small groups. And if we have time, I would like to present one of these CGC or cell group churches, so-called. There is a difference if you read the literature between a cell group church and a church that has cells or small groups. I don't think that we would make that difference, but the real, so-called real cell group churches make a very marked difference there. I don't know. It seems to me that small groups probably came into being in Israel through the schools of the prophets. From Samuel on, and maybe even before Samuel, you'll find that there always seem to be prophets in Israel and schools of prophets. We meet them again and again in the days of Samuel, in the days of Elijah and Elisha, and so on. Amos says, I wasn't a prophet. I was an agriculturalist, and the Lord took me. But there were always prophets, and there seemed to have been small schools that trained prophets. And I kind of wonder if that isn't what John the Baptist was building. He had a group of disciples that were apart from the general population. Like we read that all of Judea and Jerusalem came to be baptized by him in the Jordan. But we also find that he seems to have had a smaller group that not only came to be baptized, but that kind of stayed with him and that helped him. For example, the disciples in Luke 11, verse 1, say to Jesus, teach us to pray the way John taught his disciples. So there were some special things that John did with those disciples. Secondly, we notice that they are actively involved. There's a group that is actively involved in helping him in John chapter 3, verse 25, for example. We read, an argument developed This is chapter 3, verse 25 of John. An argument developed between some of John's disciples and a certain Jew over the matter of ceremonial washing. They came to John and said to him, "Rabbi, that man who was with you on the other side of the Jordan, the one you testified about, well, he is baptizing, and everyone is going to him." And notice here that the argument is over ceremonial washing. Now, we tend to avoid that kind of designation of baptism, ceremonial washing, but it seems to refer to baptism here. There was an argument here, and the disciples of John are concerned about this, and they come and tell him that Jesus is baptizing, and exactly as a response to these questions that have arisen. So it shows us that they were involved in the doctrine that the Baptists taught, and in the baptism that was being carried out, more so than just the average person who had repented and been baptized by John the Baptist. And we notice also that he had men that he could send on special missions. For example, in Matthew 11 and verses 2 and 3, John is in prison. When John heard in prison, verse 2, what Christ was doing, he sent his disciples to ask him, "Are you the one who was to come, or should we expect someone else?" So he could send them to look after tasks that he was not able to do. And they are also the ones who looked after him. I can imagine that in that day and age, you didn't get hamburgers in prison. And very likely you didn't get very much at all. It had to be brought by those who loved you. Otherwise, you probably more or less starved. And they are the ones who, I think, in my view of it anyway, would have taken care of that. And they also buried him after he was executed. And we notice also that after Jesus began his public ministry, John seems to have actively encouraged his disciples to keep their eye on Jesus, to follow him, to become his disciples. And some of those were originally the disciples of John. Jesus formed a special group of 12. We usually take it for granted. Yes, Jesus had his disciples. There were 12 disciples. But we seldom stop and ask ourselves, now, why did Jesus have to have disciples? Well, obviously, he used that system to prepare workers. That's the simplest answer that I can see. He was looking beyond the cross and the work that needed to be carried out, and he already prepared for it. So he chose the 12 to be with him, to learn from him, to watch him, so that they could be his witnesses, and to learn the technique of preaching and speaking to people and whatever it took to help people to know the Lord. So even though this was a thing that was known in Israel for a rabbi or a teacher to have disciples, it was known in Israel to have a small group of disciples of the prophets, Jesus built on this. He used a similar system and prepared these 12 to carry on the work after he was gone. Paul, if we look at Paul later on, he always seems to have had young men around him. When he traveled, he had Timothy, he had Titus, he had Aristarchus, he had Erastus. He had people that went with him away from Jerusalem. He had other people coming back with him to Jerusalem. Never a group of 12 necessarily, but always some to help with the work and to learn how to carry on the work of the kingdom. In our time, this small group system has been used for training workers. Bill Howell would be an example. I don't know if his name is still used, if he is known. About 15 years ago, he was quite a popular name. He used it, and he wrote books on how to train workers by using the small group system. It has been used also to delegate pastoral care, to widen the base of pastoral care, and I think that you are practicing that here as well, so that there are smaller groups that meet together every so often. And one of the main purposes of it is to make sure that people are looked after, that nobody is falling through the cracks, is not being noticed, and his needs not being met. It's kind of a way of delegating pastoral care to a wider base, because obviously the larger a church gets, the harder it is for one person to meet all the needs. We need a wider base. I've had occasionally complaints that so-and-so just wasn't meeting their need. Not from here, but from other places. And I've spoken to the board chairman sometimes and said to him, if you know there are people whose needs aren't being met in your church, you have to do something to meet that need. You need to have something on a different level, or sometimes in a different language. But you need to meet that need. And that is one of the purposes of the small group. And then it is also used as an outreach tool. A couple of years ago, we were in Washington, not Washington, D.C., the state of Washington. And we happened to be involved in, I don't know what they called it, but it was a kind of informal meeting in a home. They had a time of, I think they had a barbecue and a few things that they were doing. They had a bit of a Bible study, and there were different people. There were people who belonged to the church. There were others that were kind of interested. University students. It was a university city. And it was kind of an easygoing meeting to draw people in, a kind of an evangelistic tool. I thought was very nice. Now, a general evaluation of small groups. First of all, the advantages that I see in small groups. It sets the stage, a small group sets the stage for a closer and possibly more in-depth interaction between the leader and the group. And also between the members of the group. It makes it possible to disciple people. It makes it possible to give pastoral care, like Jesus did when he asked the disciples, "What were you arguing about along the road?" If Jesus had not walked with his disciples, he wouldn't have noticed. "What were you arguing about along the road?" And they kind of lowered their heads, and nobody said very much. And then Jesus dealt with this problem because they had been trying to decide who would be the greatest among them. Otherwise, he might not have been able to get a hold of that problem for a long time. Small groups lend themselves to a sense of belonging and being at home, with a sense of trust in the group. It can happen in a large congregation too, but it can also happen that some just slip and fall between the cracks and are unnoticed. So it may be a great boon, especially to those who experience loneliness. And in our world, there are many like that. It sets the stage also, it gives a sense of belonging and trust, and may also set the stage for a more frank sharing and a more effective dealing with problems. And lastly, a small group makes it less likely that anyone will be overlooked and neglected in the ministry of the church. Those are some of the advantages that I see of having small groups. Possible drawbacks of small group ministries. I would say, first of all, don't fall into the trap of thinking that they will solve your problems. The small group in itself doesn't solve any problems. It can be used in an effective way, but it in itself won't do that. A small group, if care is not taken, can easily be dominated by one person. All of us sometimes talk a little too much. And sometimes one person will kind of take over a group and dominate it. And it kind of puts a damper on that whole group, so that its needs are not met. So one has to work with those things. Sometimes it's even necessary to tell the brother that we appreciate who you are and what you are doing, but you need to give time also for the others to express themselves. However, I'm no guru of relevance, but something has to be done in a situation like that to keep that in focus. Sharing and praying for needs can be done in a group like this, and it's good. But sharing should not take the place of a clear teaching of the Word of God. Sharing can give us the sense of spiritual progress, but in fact, we may only have shared our mutual ignorance. So we need to make sure that we're also listening to what the Lord says, not just what we say to each other. Small groups may become too large, yet they resist forming smaller groups. Ever experienced that in a small group? We get to love each other so much that we just can't bear the thought of separating into two groups. And yet the group is a little bit too large to be a small group. A small group may be closed to the acceptance of new members. This happens too, that all of a sudden you have a stranger or a new person. He doesn't fit into that group. That group doesn't want him. He doesn't fit into that group. And actually, when this happens, and it does happen, when this happens, I think it's more devastating than if the person feels that he doesn't have a place in the big congregation. In the big congregation there, at least we can have the excuse that we just didn't notice. But in a small group, a person needs the fellowship and he can't get into the small group. There's no small group for him. Then he or she goes away more devastated than from a larger group. These latter two characteristics, namely that we are unwilling to accept new members, or that we don't want to divide, are actually close to the characteristics of a clique, I think. So we need to be careful there that we keep things in line. Our experience with small groups has always been, okay, I mentioned this before. Sometimes a church does not buy into the idea or vision of the CGC or the cell group church. Okay, I'm going a little bit further here than just the church with groups. We had one of our missionaries in Paraguay. They were really gung-ho about cell group ministry. And actually, they kind of made a nuisance of themselves when they came back from furlough. They were so full of this cell group ministry, cell group church system. They knew the ins and outs of it, and whenever we had business meetings, they knew it and they talked about it, and they were going to apply it to the church that they were and had been in the process of forming. And so they did that for, I'm not sure if it was a year or 2 years, but the church actually was against doing that. They had not bought into that. And it didn't seem to work. They couldn't seem to produce new leaders and for these groups. And basically, the basic problem, I think, was that the whole membership was against it. They probably didn't want to say it, but that's the way it was. And so finally, after probably a few years, they gave it up and the church went back to the system that they had originally. So there, I think we have to realize that it's a system that we can't force onto a church, an existing church. If you start up that way, I think the possibility of success is much greater. And either way, I think either way is acceptable. And I think also the more informal small groups is perfectly acceptable. I think it's good. Now, we have a little bit of time yet, and maybe what I'll do is I'll speak to you, I'll present to you short way, if I can, the G12. These aren't the 12 richest nations. The G12 stands for the governance or government of 12. And of course, it comes from Jesus having 12 disciples. The governance of 12, or the G12 vision, is something that Cesar Castellano, is his name, of Colombia, dreamt of, or the vision that he got or saw. Probably in the late 80s or early 90s, he made a visit to Korea, to South Korea, to Seoul, and he visited the church there that this David Yonggi Cho has, that is considered the greatest or the biggest mega church in the world. It's a full gospel church in South Korea. So he visited that, and he came back. At that time, the church wasn't as big as it is now. I understand in 2006 it had 800,000 members, approximately. You can tell that that's approximate because 800,000 is a rounded figure. So he came back from there. He had this vision how he would enlarge his church in Colombia. He returned to his church. His church in Colombia, in Bogota, Colombia, is called the Misión Carismática Internacional, the charismatic, the international charismatic mission in Bogota, Colombia. And with all this that he had learned, he had this vision of the G12, a group of 12. You start with 12 disciples, and you train them, and then each one, during the time that he trains them, each one tries to get 12 disciples as well. And once these are finished, then they in turn disciple their 12, and when that is finished, then each group of 12 splits up again, and each has another group of 12, and you can see how this thing grows exponentially. It's not just yesterday we won 2 to the Lord, and last week we won 5. No. This is multiplication. It's you're dealing, in short order, you're dealing with very large numbers. I'll read you some of the statistics that of that church. He formed his church into groups of 12, it says, while his brother-in-law, Cesar Fajardo, did the same with the youth. From 1991 to 1994, his church grew from 70 to 1,200 members. So that would be in 3 years, from 70 to over 1,000. Between 1994 and 1999, the church grew to 20,000 cells with a regular weekly church celebration of 45,000 people. Soon they lost track of numbers and began to count in cell groups. Currently, apparently, they have 55,000 cell groups and approximately 550,000 members. Whenever this was written, I'm not sure the date on this. He has a large work there. it became very popular, and people began to look to it and to visit it. And then he formed an international group of 12 that was connected with his system. And they soon parted ways, however, so that there are many groups around this type of church organization that have taken their pattern from that, but that are not directly connected with it anymore. They still have the basic G12 methodology and so on. It sounds very good. If you, especially if you look at the numbers, the one thing that I do know about this system is that it has emptied other churches. You can imagine the pressure there is to multiply. And how can you multiply faster than by inviting believers from other churches? So they have literally been a stumbling block for other churches. They have emptied other churches and grown that way. Another thing that, and I'll try to kind of finish this off here. Another thing, if you look at the structure of the church, and we don't have time to read all this, they are very much a top-down organization. Our churches, for the most part, are very congregationally oriented. We make decisions as a brotherhood. But these churches are from the top down much more. The one who has the vision is at the top, and he has 12, and each of those 12 have 12, and each of those have 12, each of those have 12, and so on. So that you have kind of a pyramid structure, and sometimes the line of command has been quite severe. You have so much time to produce five more, each cell group, to produce five more cells. And it puts a heavy load on the believers. You can just think about your church here, for example. You have older people like me, or maybe I say should say mature people like me. And you have young couples with families who need special time for that. I mean, depending on what stage we are in life, the time that we can spend changes and our needs change. And so sometimes a system like that can be quite difficult to live with, I think. I've never been in something like that, but that is one of the criticisms that we hear from that kind of system. Another is that it's very difficult to get enough skilled leaders that are capable of leading these small groups. The system, like the church that I told you about in Paraguay, I didn't tell you about the time limits here, but neighbor, R.G. Neighbor is his name. He's one of the real gurus on this type of church structure. He says 6 months till the group splits, and 6 months for the next group, and so on. And you can imagine, if you start out with 12 and you split in 6 months and do it again in 6 months and again, in how short a time you need a whole score of leaders. And that was a problem in the Paraguay experience too. You just can't produce leaders that quickly. It's just not feasible, there at least. It may be a thing that works in Seoul, Korea. The Koreans are a very disciplined people, Confucian background, very used to being told what to do probably. It may work well there. It doesn't necessarily work well here. So, in closing, on this, I don't like to close on a negative note on that, but I think I will this time. I think it's good. Small groups have been very useful in the Church of Christ. John Wesley had his bands, I've forgotten the names. He had three different words that he used. He divided his believers into small groups. He used that. And others along the way have used it. You are using small groups to a certain extent. They are useful. But one of the things that the CGC says is that, and they tend to be somewhat fanatical, they say that the CGC has recaptured the New Testament concept of the church. It's like a new reformation. The conventional churches are dead. The people aren't working. They're heavy on programs. They're too busy. And yet, when you turn around and analyze what's happening in the CGC, they also have a lot of programming, and their freedom isn't any greater than ours in the conventional churches, and very mechanistic it can become, and very demanding. So, I would say, and I haven't heard anybody say that they were planning to institute a full-blown CGC cell group church type of ministry here in La Crete. But I would say if you're seriously considering that, take a good look at some of the studies that have been made. I have a study here too made by, I think he's a man from Singapore, named by Peter Koh is his name. And he does an evaluation of the CGC type of churches. He looks at the pros and the cons. And take a look at papers like that. Think it through well and make your decision on that. If you are at the point of making a decision on a thing like that. It's been a pleasure to be with you. A challenge. I've always, all my life, I've found it hard to speak to congregations that I'm not with on a regular basis. But you have been a good congregation. I appreciate your receiving us, the fellowship we've been able to have had with you. And we wish you the Lord's blessing. And if you go in for the CGC or the G12 system when we come back, you will have built another church, not only this new one that you're planning, but you will be in the probably 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 range of members. Hopefully, all new believers. The Lord bless you.